Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading the December-January issue of Guideposts magazine with articles like Our Animal Kingdom, Guideposts Classic, Our Animal Kingdom, Now I Know What Mrs. Noah Went Through, by Madge Hara, Albuquerque, New Mexico. To me, the greatest unsung heroine of the Bible is Noah's wife. The account of the flood in Genesis barely mentions her, except to say that she was there. And yet, imagine feeding all those people and all those animals for weeks and weeks. Imagine cleaning up after them, too. Mrs. Noah should have been awarded a halo, or at least a gold medal. If you wonder why I sympathize so strongly with Mrs. Noah, let me describe a particular day at our house. It began with a warm little hand, urgently patting my cheek. "Mom, wake up. There's a big storm and we have to bring in the rabbits." Groggily, I opened my eyes and stared at the clock. 5 a.m. Windows rattled and the wind screamed down the mountain. Instinctively, I reached across the bed for my husband, Larry, but he was on a business trip. It was up to Mama again. I snapped on the light. Our 8-year-old adopted son, Eric, was rocking nervously on his feet. We had brought this happy, hyperactive child into our family 6 years ago, and he had been on the go night and day ever since, which meant that I was on the follow day and night. He was my prayer child. God knew a lot about him because I was always praying about his exhausting hyperactivity and his problems at school. Although Eric was quite bright, he had learning difficulties, and the school psychologist had placed him in a special tutoring program. Tests showed that he liked animals, so we bought some, hoping that caring for them would develop his self-esteem and sense of responsibility. Of course, the responsibility became largely mine, and I continued to fret and worry about him. But it was not Eric's fault that we had taken in enough animals to fill Noah's Ark. Eric leaped up on the bed to peek through the curtains. The window was plastered with driving snow. "Let's go, Mom. We have to save them." I stuffed myself into some winter clothes and lumbered to the back door, which was frozen shut. Eric and I heaved it open together, and we went charging out into the snow-filled darkness with a yell. I flicked on the patio light and trekked after him to the rabbit hutches. "You get Captain Midnight," he shouted through the howling wind, already toting Bucket, a kicking white male rabbit, back to the house. Captain Midnight, as black as his name, snarled and nipped at my hands as I dragged him from the cage. I shut him up in the bathroom with Bucket and slogged out with Eric again to dig away the drifts in front of the doghouse to free Benji, our Dalmatian. Then Eric led the search in a swirling shadows for Tigger and Cinderella, our two cats, finally locating them in a corner of the snow-sifted playhouse. When all were inside with doors barred, I sagged with fatigue, feeling more like Mrs. Noah than ever. How had she managed when there was no time for meditation and hardly time for prayer? Had she ever thought that God had abandoned them on a wild sea? Had she ever felt like giving up? Just then, Megan, our 4-year-old adopted daughter, came paddling into the den in her footed pajamas. "Mom," she said, "I just looked in the hamper and Spot is gone. The snake." Clenching my teeth, I reproached the well-meaning neighbor who had given the reptile to Eric. The entrance of Spot, the snake, into our lives had led directly to another addition, Popcorn, the mouse. I had learned to my dismay that snakes prefer warm, fuzzy food. Reluctantly, I had gone to the pet shop to purchase a mouse. Then, with eyes averted and ears closed to the children's wails in the next room, I dropped the mouse into the clothes hamper that was Spot's home and slammed the lid, praying silently for forgiveness. At the time, however, Spot was enjoying a snaky snooze, and Popcorn chewed his way to safety through the side of the hamper. He lived in Megan's waste paper basket, where he had earned the name Popcorn because of his habit of flinging himself against the perforated cardboard lid that covered the basket. Now Spot had chosen his frantic morning to nose through the masking tape covering Popcorn's hole and was on the prowl, ready to swallow anything that moved. I felt sure, mouse or mama. "All right," I said, pulling myself together. "Eric, you find Spot before Spot finds Popcorn, and please be careful not to let Henry out of the atrium, because hawks eat snakes." "Too late, Mommy," Megan said sadly. "I was looking for you, so I opened the door. Larry had brought Henry the hawk home for repair a few weeks earlier. He had heard on the radio that the animal shelter had injured had an injured wild bird that would be destroyed if someone didn't claim him. Good old Mr. Noah. Thanks to his care, Henry was alive and well, perching in the atrium, the small glass-enclosed courtyard in the front of our house, when he was dive-bombing innocent heads. As if in response to Megan's announcement, Henry suddenly came sweeping through the den with extended talons, barely missing our scalps before hooking himself onto the chandelier. My husband was the only one who could ever catch Henry. "Put hats on," I yelled, like Mrs. Noah calling all hands on deck. "Lord," I prayed just as fervently as she must have done, "still the storm and bring us safely through." Eric put on his football helmet and went looking for the snake, while Megan, in a sailor hat with appliqued felt fish and seagull, dug dirt from around the palmetto in the atrium to fill a litter box for the cats. Looking stunning in my straw garden hat with the green bow and my elbow-length white evening gloves as protection against the nips of a mumbling Captain Midnight, I spread newspapers on the bathroom floor for the rabbits. "The ship is sinking," I muttered. Just then, Eric let out a howl from the guest bedroom. Megan and I rushed in to find him wrestling a barking Benji, who lunged frantically toward the wire ice cream chair where Spot had coiled through the loops. Eric pulled the dog out of the room at last. "Don't worry, I got him," he said manfully, as he returned to load Spot into his arms and carry him to his mended hamper. Later, the rabbits got out and ate the telephone cord. Then Henry swooped into the kitchen and scared the hamsters into a tizzy. It was a long, long day. The wind stopped that evening, but the temperature quickly dropped to 10 degrees below zero, and I realized that all the animals would have to stay in for the night. We were just getting them settled down when, to my joy and relief, came home the dove of hope, Larry. "What in the world is going on here?" he asked, staring at the shambles. "I got worried when I couldn't reach you, so I caught an earlier flight," he exclaimed. "Did you know the phone is out of order?" "Yes, it was bunny food," I sighed. Larry quickly captured Henry and helped us batten down the rest of the hatches. When he and I were getting ready for bed, Eric came in to announce that he had made one last round of the house and that all the animals were tucked in for the night. He kissed me sweetly and then said proudly to Larry, "You should have seen Mom. She was terrific," and bounced off to bed. "You should have seen him, Larry," I whispered. "He was wonderful, darting here and there, scooping up rabbits, corralling the dog, untangling the jumbled snake, all that energy put to good use. And I was so frantic I didn't realize it until now," I paused. "Do you think God was watching over this boat the whole time?" I asked. "Yes, the whole time," Larry said. Suddenly I began to laugh. "Do you realize that under this roof tonight we have a man, a woman, a boy, a girl, and more than a dozen assorted creatures, and not a single one of us is a blood relative of the other? We are indeed on an ark, traveling through life's squalls and sunshine, but God was with us in the midst of the wind, storm, and animal stampede. Even when I doubted that there was barely time to pray, he was faithful." I tiptoed into Eric's room and pulled up the covers that he had kicked onto the floor. As I bent to kiss him, I saw on his peaceful face the proof of God's love and watchfulness, the small, sweet rainbow of his sleeping smile. A preview from Walking in Grace 2025. "So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow." 1 Corinthians 3, verse 7, NIV. I picked out a maidenhair fern at the nursery. Even after the cashier warned me that these ferns were delicate and suggested a hardier plant instead, I foolishly insisted on taking it home. Several weeks later, the maidenhair was already looking pretty rough. "If you name your plants and speak kindly to them, they'll grow better," advised my younger daughter, whose thumb had somehow proven much greener than my own. The idea seemed a bit silly to me, but I was willing to give it a try. What did I have to lose? I tried to think of an appropriate name for this poor plant that hung on despite my unwitting attempts to kill it. What popped into my mind was Miriam, the name of a friend of mine. Miriam, like the maidenhair, was delicate in her way, a kind-hearted soul with all the charms of a proper Southern belle, but she'd survived things that would surely have done in a person of lesser faith. Miriam was a survivor, which I hoped my little plant would be. Each day I complimented my fern, Miriam's beauty. I offered plenty of sunlight and the occasional steam bath. Soon my fern Miriam became strong, green, and gorgeous. Like my friend, this Miriam was resilient too. It all made me think, if calling them by name and speaking kindly to plants helps them grow, what must it do for humans? Lord, help me to be an encourager. Ginger Rue. Walking in Grace is our most popular devotional book. To order the 2025 edition, visit guideposts.org/WIG. Write to Guidepost P.O. Box 5815, Harlan, Iowa, 51593-1315, or call 800-932-2145. It is available in a hardcover edition for $16.95 or softcover large print edition for $17.95, plus shipping and processing. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you've missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. Grace and inspiration. I was searching for a reason to be joyful, but this wasn't how I ever imagined spending Christmas Eve. Alone, divorced, lost. The Perfect Gift by Vicki Kuyper, Colorado Springs, Colorado. That Christmas Eve afternoon, I finished making the deviled eggs and the cranberries for the next day's brunch. Then I wrapped the last few gifts and put them under the tree. I surveyed the room. It looked festive with the twinkling lights and the candles, and yet nothing about the scene was how I'd pictured myself spending holidays or living life in my 60s. Yes, I'd seen a lot of my son, Ryan, his wife, and my two adopted granddaughters in recent days. It always ended the same way. I returned to my new little townhouse, alone, tired. The holidays used to be my favorite time of year, a time for my family to gather and celebrate Jesus' birth. Now the season was a bittersweet reminder of how much things had changed. All the decorations, the ornaments on the trees, were pieces that my ex-husband Mark and I had collected over our 33 years of marriage. To say that it had come as a shock when Mark told me he was gay and doesn't begin to describe my pain. He said he truly tried to make our marriage work, but for him, it no longer did. Mark had always been good to me. He was my best friend and a wonderful father to our two children. He still loved me, but he had to be honest. These past 5 years had been a journey. My dreams for the future, all of which involved growing old with Mark, had to be rewritten. I asked God to help me begin again. With the passage of time, I began to heal. Mark and I now live in different states, though we remained close. Family vacations still lived up to their name, including four grandchildren, one on the way, and Mark's new life partner. I thought now that our divorce was finalized, I'd at last made peace with the way things had turned out. But that Christmas Eve, I suddenly felt so lost, so unmoored. It went beyond missing my family and the way things used to be. If my marriage wasn't what I believed it was, could I trust anything about the life Mark and I had shared, the love we'd shared for those 33 years? Could I believe that this was God's plan for my life? I shook my head. That kind of thinking wasn't going to do me any good. Maybe what I needed to lift my spirits was to dive into old family tradition. I remembered that heart-shaped potato rolls. One Christmas when the children were small, I decided to cut the rolls with a heart-shaped cookie cutter just as a little reminder of how much I love my family and how much God loved the four of us. The rolls were a big hit, and from then on, the shape was as important as the recipe. The years passed and the children grew into adults, but the heart-shaped rolls always graced our holiday table until Mark and I divorced. I turned on some Christmas music and got out all the ingredients for the rolls. Now I just had to find the heart-shaped cookie cutter. Where was it? I'd given away a lot of things over the past few years. Sometimes I thought it was to move on, but I wasn't sure I wouldn't have left the cookie cutter behind. That little metal heart had almost as many memories as my true heart. I turned my townhome upside down to no avail. I plopped down in a chair. Why go to all the trouble of making potato rolls if they were just going to be round? That one little thing, that one loss on top of everything else, was all it took for me to break down in tears. I was tired of rebuilding from what felt like scratch at my age. My friends were retiring and celebrating milestone anniversaries, while I was buckling under the weight of helping care for my young grandchildren and worrying about how I would navigate the golden years on my own, alone. Finally, I calmed down, embarrassed by this cookie-cutter meltdown. I had other things to do. Why not text Mark a Merry Christmas Eve? I grabbed my phone and told him that I was trying to make potato rolls, but they wouldn't be heart-shaped. Isn't that silly, I typed. Open my gift, Mark texted me back. What could that mean? Confused, I got up and walked across the living room. I knelt by the tree and found the box he sent. Perhaps a little surprise was just what I needed. The box didn't look too exciting, just plain brown shipping paper. I opened it and inside found three neatly wrapped gifts. I unwrapped the first one and pulled out a package of Pfeffernuss, the traditional German cookies that had been my grandmother's Christmas favorite, and so had become mine. I opened the second box. Inside was a beautiful panettone, a Christmas bread with candied fruit that I'd enjoyed when I went to school in Italy during my sophomore year of college. Now only the smallest box remained, a little square one. I held it up to my ear and shook it. Clink, clink, I tore through the paper, and there nestled inside was a set of four heart-shaped cookie cutters. I sat beneath the sparkling lights of the tree and held them in my hands. It was as if time stood still and all the memories and part of my life rose up in a swell of comfort and love, of grace that I could hold close and trust forever. The perfect timing of this perfect gift assured me that I was loved and known by both God and my family. It has been 5 years since that Christmas. It isn't always easy for others to understand how the relationships within our anything but cookie-cutter family continue to strengthen and deepen. Some days I don't quite understand it myself, but love is often a work in progress, a choice we make as much as an emotion we feel, and our family chooses to love abundantly. For more on this story, see Family Room. What Prayer Can Do: Power in Our Day-to-Day Lives by Ruth O'Neill, Lynchburg, Virginia. Something big. Christmas was coming, but presents were the last thing on my mind. I was more worried about the mortgage payment. My husband, Randy, hadn't been able to work for weeks because of a herniated disc, and now his doctor had ordered him to leave his construction job permanently. Even though our money troubles weighed on me, I never talked to anyone about them. Both Randy and I had been brought up to keep our problems at home. It set us apart from a lot of people we knew who seemed as if they'd be okay with putting their personal problems on billboards. Maybe it was a comfort for them, but I couldn't share my troubles like that. I didn't confide in anyone, not even my family. God was the only one who knew what I was dealing with. "We haven't missed a mortgage payment in 13 years," I said to Randy one night, "but I think we're going to have to do it now." "We have no choice," he said. I turned out the light, wondering if there was anything I hadn't tried yet, any avenue I hadn't considered. I remembered something a friend of mine had once told me. Pray big, so big that when it does happen, you know it was God. A mortgage payment would certainly count as something big. Even if I knew anyone with that kind of money to spare, I could never bring myself to ask them. What I did do the next day was email a couple friends from church. "I have something big I need to pray about," I wrote. "Could you pray with me?" That was all I asked. I didn't give away any specifics. God already knew what we needed. I hit send, then started on some housework. I hadn't finished vacuuming when my phone rang. It was our church secretary. "There's someone here," she said, sounding a little hesitant, even confused. "They say they want to pay your house payment this month and would like to know how much it is and where to send it." I never found out who made our mortgage payment that Christmas, but it was no secret why they did. Need prayer? Join the Our Prayer community. Submit your prayer request and pray for others at ourprayer.org. Family Room. Meet the people in our pages. When Carrie Pemeroli, Laughing Matter, page 12, isn't trying to find California's best sushi with her daughters, she's on tour nationwide, eating her way across America, and doing stand-up, of course. After my shows, I sometimes stay until midnight praying with people, and that has become my favorite part, Carrie says. I've literally seen God do miracles right after a comedy show. Her Dry Bar comedy special is out now on Angel. Look for a TV appearance in 2025 on Making Light of It, on its Supernatural network. She has several feature film projects underway. Her coaching business, Creative Communication Strategies, helps speakers and authors take their careers to the next level, working with people on their writing and punching up speeches, presentations, and more. Carrie is the author of 6 books, including Confessions of a Proverbs 32 Woman, How I Went from Messed Up to Blessed Up Without Changing a Single Thing, and its companion devotional, She Rises Late and Her Kids Make Her Breakfast, and is at work on a new book featuring her unique comic musings on faith. To follow her adventures in all things comedy and carbohydrates, go to @ Carrie Pom, K-E-R-R-I-P-O-M, Instagram, and @ K-E-R-R-I-P-O-M-A-R-O-L-L-I, Facebook. Connect with her at carriepalm.com. George Kuntz, A Deeper Faith, page 48, credits his parents with instilling both a strong faith and strong work ethic in him. His dad was the owner of a painting business, and his mom worked at Head Start Preschool. They must have had 6 sick days, but I never saw them, George recalls. They just powered through. He brings the same commitment to everything he does, whether developing partnerships as senior vice president for university relations at Miriam University or giving back to his community. In 2023, he launched the Dr. George E. Kuntz Scholars Program at Miriam to provide academic and financial support to students in need so they can succeed in college. I want kids to see there is a world of opportunity when they earn a college degree, he says. George was recently selected to chair a committee exploring options for a new jail in his county that emphasizes restorative justice. You shouldn't lose your humanity just because you go to jail, he says. He serves on a number of boards, including the Green Bay Packers Board of Directors and the Nature Conservancy, Wisconsin. His connection to nature goes way back. Growing up in eastern North Carolina, I was free to explore rivers, fields, forests, the ocean, lakes, and parks, he says. That really exposed me to God's creation and God's beauty. Dolores Leisner, The Butler Did It, page 47, and her husband Ken love getting lost together, finding unique epitaphs in cemeteries, checking out remote farm stands, and meeting new friends wherever they go. A favorite pastime is reminiscing about past adventures, such as their bicycle trip through Wisconsin's picturesque Door County, where they got caught in the rain twice, swallowed bugs, forgot the map, and had to be rescued, missed the last boat off an island, and ended the day with legs dyed blue from rain-soaked new jeans. Laughter and prayer have carried them through 62 years. Their secrets to a happy marriage? Being thankful for all that did not happen. Dancing every Friday after work, and praying together daily when remembering why we fell in love, Dolores says. Their nicknames say a lot about them. She dubbed her methodical, organized husband, Bridge Builder, while Ken calls his spontaneous and often distractive wife, Puddle Jumper. Dolores encourages her scripture buff and colorblind artist hubby as he paints or creates beautiful stained glass. He cheers her on as she writes and does public speaking, and as she celebrates her love of books by reading a new Christmas book or story every day in December. Kate J. Meyer, Being Present, page 30, grew up hearing her dad encourage her to work hard, play hard, and learn a lot, and it's now her mantra. Whether snuggling up with her chocolate lab and a psychological thriller, riding roller coasters, adventuring with her friends, or exploring with her husband, Kate embraces play as often as she can. She also never turns down a quiet solo night at home. Still an avid student, Kate recently earned 2 grief counseling certifications to help her keep up to date both in practice and her writing. Her first nonfiction book, Faith, Doesn't Erase Grief, Embracing the Experience and Finding Hope, focuses on the intersection of grief work and Christian faith. She provides grievers with tools to navigate grief and move forward into continued living. Kate is currently working on a new grief-related project with Lake Drive Books, as well as a 3rd novel in her self-published fiction series, Lake Harbor Chronicles. You can learn more at her website, katejmeyer.com. Over the past 35 years, Vicki Kuyper, The Perfect Gift, page 66, has written everything from inspirational books, including A Tale of Two Biddies, A New Wrinkle on Aging with Grace, to travelogues, greeting cards, crossword puzzles, and cat pun calendars. When Vicki isn't writing, she's hanging out with her 5 grandchildren or exploring distant corners of the world. She has visited 62 countries and all 7 continents, including Antarctica. Last summer, Vicki traveled to the African country of Rwanda. Given its turbulent history, she was a bit apprehensive, but the modern beauty of the capital city of Kigali, the warmth of the people, and the jaw-dropping privilege of photographing endangered mountain gorillas made Rwanda a favorite destination. Led by trackers and a guide, Vicki returned to the Virunga Mountains of northern Rwanda. Only about 1,000 mountain gorillas live in the wild. 1/3 of that population is in this region. Watching the massive silverbacks crash through the underbrush and the baby gorillas frolic and play reminded her of her own grandchildren. Vicki's advice to other intrepid travelers, always bring your camera and your insatiable curiosity. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.